Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by Mr. Chris Hassan. Chris, how are you doing?
Hi, Nick. Hi, Makone. Doing well, thanks. Glad to be on with you guys today.
Good to have you back. And of course, Makone Maja. Makone, thank you for hosting while I was away, and welcome back to the show.
Had tons of fun. Good to be here with you both.
So we're just going to start off with a bit of a light item. And this is a new political contender has put himself forward as being the next president of South Africa. And this is, of course, one of Jacob Zuma's sons, Duduzane Zuma, who says that he is going to be, despite being a member of the ANC, who presumably is putting up Cyril Ramaphosa for the job, is going to be running for president of the country. Perhaps he's going to take advantage of the ability to run as an independent candidate. He said, "We need change, and I believe I am the change this country needs now. The time has come for us as youth to take the running of the country into our hands. It's now time for the old people to gracefully leave and let the country and take the country forward. If they really mean what they say, when the youth is the future, they must let us decide our destiny by letting us run the country." So I look forward to his spectacularly unsuccessful presidential campaign. Anyway, on to serious news. Let's talk a little bit about the sheer cost of Eskom, of government's inability to fix Eskom. So there's a media report out now which talks about the projected expenditure by government on Eskom since the beginning of the crisis in 2008, the beginning of the load shedding crisis, and just how much they've actually spent on trying to fix the problem with, well, as we can see, not really much result, considering the fact that I suspect most of the people watching this don't have electricity right now. By March of 2026, government is projected to have spent 495.6 billion rand on bailouts to Eskom. Now, to be fair, a lot of that money hasn't quite been spent yet. About 254 billion rand is included in a relief package, which has been earmarked by Finance Minister Enoch Godongwana to be given to Eskom if it meets certain performance requirements. And so that's sort of in the budget, but hasn't, I think, yet been spent yet. But there's at least another 250 billion-ish rand that has been spent by government in various bailouts to Eskom. And despite some improvement in its debt situation, it still remains, I believe, somewhere close to 400 billion rand in debt. And is in total junk credit status, unable to keep its infrastructure going. And Godongwana has ruled out further cash injections for Eskom, saying that now it's really time for it to sink or swim. But I don't really buy that in the slightest, because government has said that many, many, many times before, that now, no, this really is the last time we're bailing out Eskom. It's the last time we're giving them any money, only to do it down the line. In fact, before this current 250 billion rand package that they proposed, I think they'd already said that it was time for paying off Eskom was over. Chris, what do you make of this story? What should we take from this? I mean, I think this puts it in a nice perspective of, you know, we know about lots of economic costs that have been accrued by the country because of load shedding, but here is a much easier to digest, less speculative number, which is half a trillion rand from government budget has just disappeared over the last sort of, 10 years more in trying to fix Eskom. What do you make of this?
Yeah, and even there, it makes it all the more difficult to make this case for a developmental state, as it were. So if you're on that side of the argument, if you have this idea that the state should capacitate growth, spend on infrastructure, now you look at that massive spend, where that could have gone, what it could have been spent on, if you look at things like, I don't know, maybe welfare grants for people who really need it, or some sort of education reform, if there was actual meritocracy in the public education department, all that sort of stuff, in terms of upskilling the majority of South Africans, getting them into economic activity, how much better that would have been instead of wasting it in this this black hole that Eskom has turned out to be, much like SAA over the years, getting all those bailouts, where it has mostly just been used in recent times to fly people around. There was a report out this morning about how much it cost the private charter to get Thabo Bester back from Tanzania. It might even but I'm sure it's less than the amount that SAA has been given, but you get the idea of these frivolous enterprises and spending. So it's a sad story, of course, but a good and accurate summation of just how much has been wasted in terms of trying to get Eskom into any kind of into any kind of state where it can deliver upon its, you know, quote unquote mandate of cheap, reliable electricity for South African citizens.
So, I mean, you know, the ANC likes to talk at length about its social spending and the kind of things that, you know, giving people houses, giving people electricity, giving people social grants. You just take that figure, what is it, 500 billion-ish rand, which is, I think, something close to a third of the yearly government budget, if I stand corrected there, perhaps. But anyway, and, you know, even if you were just going to spend that on sort of social spending and social goods, rather than tax alleviation or something that maybe more free market people might like, you could have presumably achieved quite a lot. What's your thoughts on this story?
Well, Nick, I think you make a great illustrative point of showing that one, government finances and resources are finite. So if bailouts are being made, that means budgetary cuts are probably being enforced in other areas of expenditure, right? And you can't point to the social grant system or even education as one of the ways we see government cuts taking place to accommodate bailouts. But certainly you can point to infrastructure, right? Because the consequences are not immediately felt. They span years and years before one starts to manifest dilapidation across infrastructure. So that's one thing, is government has to make budgetary cuts to accommodate these constant bailouts. But on the bailouts themselves, I think it's bailouts are another way of subsidizing poor government decision-making, right? And insulating government and state-owned entities against their own bad decisions, but also especially against corruption. I wonder how much of that figure that's being spent or potential being kept in the wings for Eskom is going to go to all the sabotage activities, right? Those very fancy luxury 200,000 Rand mops and 80,000 Rand knee pads. How much of these bailouts are actually provisioned for instances of corruption, instances of sabotage?
So one last thing I just want to ask you, Chris, is my skepticism about government being, you know, holding back on the purse strings on Eskom. Do you think it's, I suspect that pretty much regardless of what happens, Eskom is so desperate politically to, or sorry, government's so desperate politically to fix Eskom that regardless of what the finance minister says, at the end of the day, they are going to pay any amount of money they think might improve the situation at Eskom to perhaps buy them a little bit more life in the electoral, in the next election. What do you make of that?
No, I think the incentives are absolutely there, based on their own internal polling, in terms of polling from many other organizations, including the CRA, the ANC likely coming in below 50% in next year's election. So needing to pursue any and all sort of avenues to shore up some of that support at the moment, because of, again, the confusion between powers, if you'll excuse the pun, powers of certain ministers, with apparently Ramaphosa, again, this doing this about turn on the taking away powers from Mantashe to the new Minister of Electricity. Even from macro level to the very bottom level of doing basic maintenance, we're not going to see an improvement, a substantial enough improvement in Eskom's coal fleet in terms of that maintenance to ensure that load shedding ends before the election. So that means buying more diesel, for example, running certain pieces of equipment into the ground and getting backups where you possibly can. If that means importing them, fine, but you spend the money where you need to. So I want to give Treasury and the Minister of Finance an element of credit for the latest budget and some of these requirements. For example, the 254 billion rand in the February budget for Eskom hinged to certain concessions and requirements that Eskom needs to implement. Whether Treasury can toe the line on that remains another issue. So I like the different pragmatic talk and a bit of a shift there, different from what we've heard before. But when it comes to implementation on the ground, you're not yet seeing the proof of that. So ultimately, it depends on what happens on the ground. It doesn't mean just because the talk is lofty and all that sort of stuff. We saw it with the latest investment conference from President Ramaphosa. Doesn't mean that the reality on the ground reflects that. So we'll need to see if government can hold the line there. You could see, for example, within Eskom and associated SOEs, a bigger push by the unions for higher wage increases, which could then be the sort of the straw that breaks the camel's back in terms of more spending. Because without that, then there'll simply be a mass downing of tools and just no work being done. So that could be one way for different players within Eskom to put a lot of pressure on Treasury and the Minister of Finance and to make him go back on his word about not granting Eskom more money.
We've said 1,000 times before on the show, but the ways to solve it, load shedding, Eskom, end BE in procurement and hiring, deregulate the system so that it's easier to build new power generation. Don't be too picky about what your source of electricity is, especially in the short term, what the generating method is. And, you know, take on the unions, especially when it comes to firing non-performing staff, so that you can get Eskom's wage bill under control. All right, let's move on to our next story for today. And this is some interesting comments made by the Veterans League, Snooki Zikalala, over the weekend. So the Veterans League is a part of the ANC that once was more influential than it is today. It seems to have greatly diminished in power, though I think it still does hold some sway. And the Veterans League talked mostly about how, during this meeting, how worried they are that the ANC is in trouble, as Chris said just now, dropping below 50% in the next election, and that they believed that they needed to focus on renewing and strengthening the ANC so that it is capable of continuing to win a majority in the next national elections in Parliament. However, there were some interesting comments made by Zikalala, who said, I think that the EFF is done. And so he then went on to talk about how he believed that the ANC actually needed to seriously consider a possible coalition with the DA after the 2024 elections. He said, quote, the only issue there is the red line with the DA is their issue of racism. So if they are able to sort this out, then maybe we could work with them. So obviously, you know, he's continuing the old ANC line there of saying the DA is just a racist organization. But I think this is quite interesting because, firstly, his comments are that the EFF is a spent political force, which is one that you don't actually hear that often in our political discourse. I think Gareth van Onselen has written about it a bit, but there's not that much mainstream endorsement of that view. But we often talk about, you know, whether the DA should go into coalition with the ANC, and us on the show, many of our people have said here that that's a really bad idea, but we haven't really talked about it from the ANC's perspective. So, McCorner, let me start with you here. Do you think, firstly, that the ANC is ever seriously going to consider a coalition with the DA if one was offered, and we don't know whether one would even be offered? And if so, would it actually be good for the ANC in the long term? What do you make of all this?
There's an overture of desperation there where you see the ANC Veterans League call the DA racist, but also show a willingness and an openness to partner with these racists for their presidential bid come 24. So very interesting to observe how racism, after all, is not that big of a problem as purported to be. Do I think the ANC would consider the DA seriously? No, I don't think that, given the fact that the DA has been on opposition for the longest time, constantly flagging and pointing out whether it's the mismanagement of funds from the ANC or just the lack of political will, there is a potential for them to put their differences, which span what, decades now, differences aside to form a meaningful partnership. Nor do I think there's a seriousness in the DA. Well, they don't outright condemn it. They leave it, so they park it sort of there for people to explore and debate about, maybe so that they can themselves arrive at a conclusion once public opinion has beat around this issue long enough, but I don't see that there's a serious willingness on their part to join forces with the ANC either.
So, Chris, what do you make of this story? I mean, I think we've talked a little bit before about, you know, the potential negatives of a DA-ANC coalition government for the country and also for the DA probably. But what do you take on this story, and do you think that it would be to the ANC's benefit to go into coalition with the DA if one was offered after 2024?
I think it's probably more to the ANC's benefit to go into coalition with the DA than with the EFF. And I say that because I see most of the structures and the sort of thought within the DA is still playing on the grounds of a state that functions, of a state doing certain things. And I think some within the ANC would have resonance with that. Whereas you have the EFF being very much personality-driven, character-driven. You've got the rhetoric of revolution. I mean, I don't think they would really be serious about implementing that. That means giving up way too many of the niceties that they've gotten used to. But at least you'll have a much stronger force pushing the ANC in a direction. And I'm not just talking about sort of leftism as such, but a more radical populism, that sort of thing, that many within the ANC might not, you know, find resonance with.
Right. At the moment, you know, the ANC always seems to be willing at least a little bit to put the brakes on when they encounter serious resistance to their sort of leftward push. It doesn't mean they're changing their mind. It just means they sort of will slow walk policy things. But with the EFF in government, you get the feeling that those brakes would be completely disabled. McCorney, what do you make of the idea that the EFF is a spent political force and it's not going anywhere?
Yeah, so there's statistics out there capping the EFF's potential for growth at 15%. So that would assume that they're almost at their peak. I think a lot of South Africans have grown tired with the EFF, especially among the workforce, not so much among the youth. I think the message of the EFF is still attractive. Socialism is, of course, very attractive to students who've never had to pay taxes a day in their lives. But you could just see from the national shutdown and the response from the workforce, the working class, particularly, that the EFF does not have much room for growth amongst those people, which is where I would expect them to really sow their seeds. But no, I would tend to agree that no further growth from them past 15%.
It is kind of one of the great interesting points that we've made in our polling and such as to why the EFF has such anemic growth in the country. You think, you know, radical socialist movement, a party that feeds off of racial grievance, that proposes radical so-called poor policies that, you know, promise lots of stuff to people who are suffering, in a country with enormous amounts of unemployment, with 40%-ish unemployment, with the social problems we have, with the racial tensions and history that we have had. But then when you actually look at the data of what South Africans think, time and time again, you see that they're far more moderate and far more attached to the orderly development and progression of society than they are to radical revolutionary change. And you think with a crisis like load shedding, if that consciousness doesn't develop in the South African population, I wonder whether it ever really will. Chris, any final thoughts before we move on?
Just in terms of if you assess the possibility of either coalition, so ANC DA or ANC EFF, on a sort of map of what retains and what extends CADA networks and CADA influence and that sort of access to resources, which one is better for that to continue? That might be a way to also try and make sense of what could be more probable versus, you know, this personality and that personality. I think that could be because it might sound quite base, but maybe it boils down to those sorts of incentives, regardless of who happens to be in power. But how do you ensure that that continues? And I think many within the ANC realize once they lose access to that kind of that level of resources, how quickly the party will die, which arguably is already dying. So once you cut off that funding, how quickly the structures will wither away, they'll go to other places, all that sort of stuff. That might be one way to try and make sense of what could happen next year.
No, definitely. Anyway, we will see, because I think the DA has got a lot of flack in public for from its own supporters for talking about the possibility of not so much as talk about the possibility, but refusing to 100% rule out any kind of alliance with the ANC. So it's interesting to see that the ANC is also now talking about it in public too.
Sorry, Nick, just one last thing, yes. If I may. Yeah, just from the DA side, you also asked the question, do they see themselves as remaining a strong principled opposition that will always be under maybe 25% at most, and they're fine with that role in the South African democratic space, being the biggest player in an opposition coalition, or do they take the risk of going into that coalition with the ANC to quote-unquote have this wider appeal, but maybe losing a sense of who they are? Where is the ultimate, there's sort of the hierarchy of values. Where is that ultimately? I think it's going to be interesting to see how that shakes out, because I wonder if there's an element of, we're not growing, let's just, chips on the table.
That temptation will certainly be there. And I think it's probably in their interest to resist it. Anyway, let us go on to our next story. And this is not actually a story from South Africa, but it does concern us. And this is about a study done by the U.S. Congress's Ways and Means Committee on the effects of the U.S. International Trade Commission and its African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA, as it's more commonly known, which is a beneficial trade scheme that has been applied to many countries across Africa. The idea is to boost U.S. trade with Africa, to increase U.S. influence over Africa by developing strong economic ties, and also to, in theory, develop some industries in Africa that are able to benefit from these lowered or eliminated tariffs in trading with the United States. The Ways and Means Committee report found that AGOA has been a bit of a mixed bag, in their opinion, that it has had some successes for sure, but that it's not as widespread or as uniform as they would like. It found that it has a positive, that it did have a positive impact on poverty reduction, and that it had really helped out countries of Madagascar, Kenya, Lesotho, Mauritius, and Ethiopia. However, the report did say that there were only 5 countries of the many across Africa that are included in AGOA, which had sucked up almost all of the benefit, and that was South Africa, Kenya, Lesotho, Madagascar, and Ethiopia. So the program is up for renewal at the end of September in 2025, so not too far away. And it has been some pushback by various members of Congress as to whether to renew this or whether to renew it in the same way. Indeed, there's even been a little bit of a push to maybe exclude South Africa from AGOA because of our anti-American foreign policy. Chris, what do you make of all this?
Yeah, potentially losing that access to AGOA and just more agreeable terms with trade with the US and other Western partners could be behind why President Ramaphosa recently sent a delegation to Washington. So that's maybe realizing that it's not all just talk, and they could, some of these agreements could actually fall away. I take on board the finding that maybe AGOA hasn't been as beneficial as it could have and should have been. And I think that comes down to both parties. So on the South African side, things like load shedding, higher tariffs, issues around moving your goods, your commodities around and getting them out to places like the US or export markets, that would increase the cost of those. So it's fine if you've got preferential procurement in the US, but you still increase the cost of your own exports if you don't have some of these basic things right. From the US side, always 99% of the time using their influence in things like the World Trade Organization, other world bodies, to talk a big game around free trade, but in actual fact subsidizing a lot of their own manufacturing and supply and not operating on a sort of level playing field with countries around the world. It's obviously difficult between bigger and smaller economies, but you can at least have these things being transparent and done in a way that is sort of economically researched and pragmatic in a way. So I think AGOA could be improved if it is renewed. I don't think it's a panacea for South Africa's economic woes. But on average, if you're entering now a global environment, as is the case at the moment, of lower growth, the IMF is finding this now, projecting that for this year, the World Bank, others, if you're in that context, you need to make sure that you've got as much access to developed markets as possible. Number one, for your exports, but number two, also for that skill sharing and skills development. Getting that reciprocity here as well, so you can upskill South Africans here, they can work here, they can educate, they can hopefully receive higher forms of education and build businesses here that are globally interconnected. You don't want to cut yourself off from the world's most advanced economy. And even there, because of the influence that the US has with countries like South Korea, Taiwan, if you upset the US too much, you lose access to all of that advanced computational power, all of that sort of stuff. So you really need to be careful about the sort of signals you send out into the world. And up until this point, the Ramaphosa administration, I think, sending all the wrong kind of signals.
So one other interesting thing contained in the report is that according to the U.S. Ways and Means Committee, AGOA benefits appear to be essential for sub-Saharan Africa countries to continue to maintain their apparel exports to the United States. Makone, what do you make of the story and our relationship with the U.S. and AGOA in general?
I found that take about apparel exports to be rather, I think it was they were trying to send out a specific message, because when you look at trade across AGOA, you see that it's more petroleum based. And then when you eliminate petro goods, you find that South Africa obviously has the biggest contribution to AGOA. I think something like 70% of the imports of AGOA come from South Africa. And where non-petroleum goods are concerned, we're looking at things like vehicles. South Africa tops those charts again in terms of being the biggest South Africa exports, US imports of vehicles. And that's where most of the exports come from. Also from exotic minerals, which I think will grow as we see this move towards green energy and green vehicles. Exports of minerals like cobalt, lithium. Cobalt, obviously, that's Congo. Lithium, but platinum and nickel, that's obviously very concentrated and well concentrated in South Africa. But I think AGOA has been mutually beneficial for South Africa and the US. They get our goods for cheap, and obviously we get the benefits of tariffs being lifted off of these products. And given that South Africa is the biggest importer or contributor of imports, in the AGOA agreement, I would say there is a good argument to be made for South Africa giving into whatever concessions the US may have in terms of this whole Russia-Ukraine conflict. But looking at the six countries that export to AGOA, in second place is Kenya by a mile by far. And then the rest of sub-Saharan Africa contributes less than 1% of the imports, which in US context is still quite huge. 1% is a couple hundred likely billion dollars. But I don't know. It may expire in 2025. It's up to the US to gauge whether or not it's mostly beneficial to them and then consider extension, another extension.
All right, let's move on, I think, to one last quick story. And this is regarding the SABC board, which has been unappointed for quite a while now. In fact, it was not appointed for so long that President Ramaphosa was even taken to court over not appointing the board of the SABC. And of course, the SABC remains probably by far the most influential media institution in the country, where an enormous number of people get entertainment and news from. Well, President Ramaphosa appears to have finally appointed some members of the board this after 6 months today. In a statement appointing a group of people to the board, he said, "The SABC is a vital institution of our constitutional democracy. I trust the newly appointed board members will work hard at ensuring that South Africa continues to benefit from a stable, independent, and effective national public broadcaster." Here's my very hot take for you to deal with very quickly, Makone. It was actually a good thing that there's no board of the SABC, because it meant that using the SABC as a coordinated propaganda tool in favor of the government was not possible. And now it's going to be able to do that. What's your thoughts on that?
Very compelling. But I think if you look at how the SABC was being used as a vehicle for state capture, and how South Africans usually shrug now when the president does not appoint a board or does not make a decision, and they resign it to another moment of being indecisive on the part of the president. But I would argue there's something a bit more sinister there, as we saw during the State Capture Commission itself, where the then minister of Joe Maswanganyi was held liable for not appointing a board to PRASA, which ended up rendering it dysfunctional, right? And like, so we're pointing out that without a board, then the PFMA, the Public Finance Management Act, is rendered dormant because you're not able to compile reports. The people who are supposed to be compiling these reports are not appointed. So I would argue there's far more than meets the eye than just another moment of President Cyril Ramaphosa's indecision. In fact, I would argue it's become a political tool for state capture, this whole not appointing or leaving boards vacant for months and months on end.
All right. Well, we are out of time, so I won't be able to come to you, Chris. But thank you very much, everyone, for listening. We hope that you enjoyed the show, and we will be back tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.